America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when we are coming up to a great commemoration tomorrow. The commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the death of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. President Obama has been marking the Kennedy assassination all week. He spoke earlier about John F. Kennedy and his legacy. I think it's a very, very strange speech from the president. We will hear some of that a little bit later this hour. But one of the things that has been largely lost that I think is worth recovering in all of the obsessive attention to President Kennedy's killing and to his passing and to who he was and what he really meant. And by the way, we will have available to you as soon as tomorrow a brand new history program. It's a 4-hour history program about the truth about JFK. And it's the truth about both his death and his life, with much more focus on his life. But that will be available at MedvedHistoryStore.com. Meanwhile, John Fitzgerald Kennedy wasn't the only notable world figure who died on that particular day 50 years ago tomorrow. There was also C.S. Lewis. And for those of you who don't know, C.S. Lewis has been one of the most successful authors of all time. Over 200 million, that's right, 200 million of his books have been sold. And as somebody who has published 12 books of my own, I would settle for some fraction of that 200 million, and I imagine my guest would too. His name is John West. He is a prolific author. He is an author of a book about C.S. Lewis and also the creator of a very special video about C.S. Lewis, who died 50 years ago tomorrow. John is also the director of the Discovery Institute right here in Seattle, and vice president of Discovery Institute, where he's associate director of the Institute Center for Science and Culture and director of the C.S. Lewis Fellows Program on Science and Society. John, great to have you.
Michael, great to be here.
And this our Science and Culture Hour from Discovery Institute. All right. Would Lewis be amused by the fact that he shared a date of passing with such an extraordinarily famous and celebrated world figure as John Kennedy?
Lewis had a great sense of humor, so he might well be amused or bemused. On the other hand, he liked to say that he didn't like to pay any attention to politics, and he wouldn't even read newspapers. So I'm not sure how much he even knew of John F. Kennedy while he was alive. So, but he would probably be somewhat abused.
Well, he must have known something. I mean,
he did. I mean, I'm overstating. He would like to joke on that. He actually was very well read in things, and we know from his private letters did have quite a number of thoughts on things. And of course, he had an American wife, which by the time Kennedy died, she had died. But they obviously had lots of conversations about America, and they had lots of correspondence from Americans who really kept them alive after World War II, when he and his brother, like many people, were subject to rationing, and you know, the economic conditions were really bad. He had a fondness for Americans because they lived off of American hams and a lot of other things that people who read him sent him in the post-war era right after World War II.
Now, Lewis was a very, very well known in Great Britain. He was known for his radio broadcasts, among many other things. And he's probably best known in this country and maybe even around the world for Chronicles of Narnia, one of the most successful books for children or young readers of all time. Did he consider Narnia his most important product?
That's a good question. No, I don't think he did. I mean, he had various favorites. He wrote adult fiction, but and then as a scholar, he was really outstanding. His era was medieval and Renaissance English lit, and so he was still very well respected for that. And I think his adult novels, he went back and forth. He wrote some science fiction, one of which he really loved, Perelandra, and also a book, Till We Have Faces, based off of Greek myths that somewhat reflected his wife, the main character. And so, now, The Chronicles of Narnia, though, was an exercise in his imagination. He did write seven of them, and so he did enjoy them, but I don't think he would have considered that his most important legacy.
Well, he was great friends with J.R.R. Tolkien, who had his own success, to say the least, with Lord of the Rings.
And in fact, Lewis, by his private encouragement of Lord of the Rings, that's another benefit that we have of the way he really encouraged Tolkien to bring that to completion, and then was one of its early boosters when a lot of people looked down on it. I mean, it's hard to think of today as people looking down on Lord of the Rings, but when it was published, it was regarded as passé. Fantasy literature was out. It was too didactic, according to some people. And Lewis was sort of a one-man booster, writing reviews and other things, really praising it before many people really saw its greatness.
Now, one of the things that you're bringing up, and I think that's the subject of this 17-minute video that people can access, and you can watch it for free. It's on YouTube. It's called C.S. Lewis and Intelligent Design. Lewis had a great deal to say about science, even though his professorships were not in science.
Correct. He had an extreme interest, though, in the impact of science and culture, both how good it could be and, in fact, how a belief in God actually helped get science going. Lewis wrote about that in one of his books, about how the belief in the order of the universe helped inspire early scientists. But then on the negative side, when science sort of became, in a detour in the 19th century, fused with materialism, how that sort of scientific materialism that were just blind matter in motion, and especially Darwin was part of that story, that could be really abused into, and especially when it was fused with the welfare state. And so you had people claiming in the name of science, we have the right to regulate everything from your diet to who breeds with other people, you know, eugenics. These were the sorts of things that he was seeing in his own time, where you had British intellectuals and scientists, both from the right and the left, who were saying, well, we need to use modern science, Darwinian science, to breed a master race. And it wasn't just in Nazi Germany where they were saying things like that. And Lewis was a fierce critic of that sort of misuse and abuse of science, really in the service of totalitarianism and authoritarianism. And so his books like The Abolition of Man and his novel That Hideous Strength really are prophetic. I mean, if you read them today and see some of the things happening currently, from, you know, the attempt to ban sugary drinks in New York City a year or two ago, to efforts by the so-called transhumanists to breed a post-human future, these are the sorts of things that Lewis worried, if science continued to be connected with materialism, that is what would happen. And so, you know,
okay, I think it might be useful, John, if we just pause for a moment, for because I know there's some people out there, believe it or not, who haven't read any C.S. Lewis yet. Other than watching this excellent video, which people can do for free, they can go to our website, to michaelmedved.com, click on the Science and Culture banner, and that should connect them to see this new video that you've been responsible for. If you were to suggest one book that would be the best introduction to C.S. Lewis and demonstrate to people why his voice was so important, that voice we lost 50 years ago, what book would it be?
That's a hard thing to do. But I was going to actually suggest a biography by George Sayer, which is one of his friends, is probably still the best biography of Lewis. But
Screw Tape Letters.
Oh, by Lewis.
By Lewis.
You meant that. Oh, no. Yes. No, yeah. That's right. Well, I would actually say The Abolition of Man.
The Screwtape Letters, the reason people might enjoy it is Lewis actually was reading other people's mail. And this preserves the letters of a senior devil to a junior devil who is having a tough time leading people into doubt and despair. And it gives all the indications. And it's incredibly witty, very amusing, and quite profound.
And when you realize that that was another thing he wrote during World War II, when many people were, I mean, not only the normal day-to-day things that were weighing down on people, but the just oppressiveness of what was happening during World War II, especially in Britain and other countries that were, you know, being bombed and attempted to be destroyed by Hitler. And then you realize that is the context. This did offer a lifeline to many people. That and his broadcast talks on the radio, which you mentioned, which became collected as a book, Mere Christianity.
Yes, and I know that there is a science fiction novel, actually, that I read years ago that suggested in future years people would be called mere Christians, who were people who followed the wonderful C.S. Lewis book, Mere Christianity. We're speaking with John West about C.S. Lewis and what he meant and why he was important. I want to get very specifically to that old idea that somehow faith and science are incompatible. Lewis said emphatically not that faith and science can and must, in fact, coexist. If you disagree with that proposition, or you have other questions or comments for John West of Discovery Institute, please give us a call.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show. That's 1-800-955-1776.
Minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show, joined by my friend John West. He is a fellow at Discovery Institute, where he is also associate director of the Center for Science and Culture. This is, in fact, our science and culture hour on the Michael Medved Show. John has written or edited 12 books, including The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society, the C.S. Lewis Reader's Encyclopedia, and Darwin Day in America, How Our Politics and Culture Have Been Dehumanized in the Name of Science. And it's one of those things, there seem to be so many ironies about this. Charles Darwin was born on exactly the same day as Abraham Lincoln, on February 12th, 1809. C.S. Lewis died on exactly the same day as both John F. Kennedy and Aldous Huxley. On November 22nd, 1963, Aldous Huxley wrote the great dystopian novel Brave New World, among many other things. Huxley had long family connections to Charles Darwin himself. What was Lewis's attitude toward Darwin and his work?
Yeah, that's really fascinating. He was one of the people who was very critical of the idea that an unguided process could produce us, and really critiqued what he called evolutionism, which is this mindless idea that through a mindless process, anything that was just simple, if you had enough time, could become complex. And he said that if you actually look at what we know about nature, though, or what we know from human world, for example, he said, he would point out that some people would say, well, look, you used to have a simple train engine, and now you have the modern steam engine or the modern diesel engine, and that shows evolution. And he said, but in fact, what you look there is that what produced both of those was something even greater, the mind of man or the mind of genius. And so his point was that you really couldn't have the sort of things like the human mind, for example, without understanding that the cause of that had to be at least as rational as the human mind itself, and that it couldn't be caused by an unguided blind process. So when it comes to Darwin's theory of whether we came from one universal common ancestor, Lewis didn't really have big objections to that, although he was somewhat skeptical, especially later in life. People may remember the old Piltdown Man hoax, that for several decades, the scientific community was just agog that they thought they had found this wonderful missing link that turned out to be a composite fossil that someone had forged. Lewis, interestingly enough, in a poem before it was exposed as a forgery, actually poked fun at it and was kind of skeptical. And when it was exposed, he had great amusement. So although he didn't object, certainly as a Christian, to common ancestry, he was somewhat skeptical of those claims, but what he was really skeptical of was this idea that unguided natural selection acting on just these random variations, chance variations, could get you the sort of complexity that we see. And the interesting story about that is his doubts about that came about even when he was an atheist. When he was recovering from wounds from World War I, he read a book called Creative Evolution by a French Nobel laureate who gave a really stringent critique of natural selection and how much it can and cannot do. And Lewis was persuaded by that even while he was an atheist.
1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. Let's go to Tony in Philadelphia. You're on the Medved Show with Dr. John West.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm glad you came on. I've been toying with this insight on C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters, Screwtape being the senior devil, writing to his nephew, Wormwood, and how he used persuasion and misdirection, especially when the person he's tempting joins the church, and how he tells him, don't fight against the church. Look at the women who's overdressed. Look at other things. And he turned them into the individuals to turn the people, or him against the people, and thus the church. And the one thing he said was that you will feast in hell on their despair. And it made me think, my goodness, could we not put the current administration, the president, as screw tape and Hillary Clinton as wormwood? Or, I mean, it seems that the Democrats and C.S. Lewis kind of pointed this out, are feeding on despair. I've been wanting to write a blog, but I've been toying this idea for a couple of weeks now.
John West.
I don't think I'm going to touch that comparison, but your point that Lewis had a real insight about propaganda and the dangers of that. Lewis said something very interesting that's very applicable politically and to other things, is that, you know, often people in his elite, the people in the elites pride themselves in that they're so sophisticated and that they won't just be credulous or gulled at things. Lewis, in his novel, That Hideous Strength, actually paints a really interesting portrait of the educated classes, where he has a group of propagandists say, we don't have to worry about persuading the educated classes because they'll believe anything. As long as you dress it up into intellectual matters or as fashionable or in the name of science, they'll believe anything. The problem is with more ordinary people who have this basic common sense that they can't necessarily be persuaded of anything, and so you have to really manipulate them. But Lewis pointed out that many of the most sophisticated people who think that they're the best and brightest, I mean, think about the new atheists today who actually like to call themselves the brights, which means that they're calling
Daniel
everyone else.
Dennett has been on this show talking about that.
Which means everyone else is stupid. And Lewis' incisive view is that, in fact, the herd mentality among those in the elites actually is more gullible than, you know, the people that they're looking down on. And so Lewis was really incisive about how educated elites are very susceptible and blindsided by the fact that they in fact are not questioning their own assumptions. And we see this today in science.
Let's go to Paul in Cleveland. You're on the Michael Medved Show with Dr. John West.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm seeing a pattern here, and I'm just wondering why is this show so seems to be so anti-Darwinism? Why does it seem like it's all these discussions have to do with being against the theory of natural selection?
Now, it's again not against the theory of natural selection, against the idea that somehow life itself, and then the higher forms of life, of which human beings are the best example, that all of that evolved through an unaided, random, purely natural, unguided process. That strikes me as profoundly irrational. I have absolutely no sense.
Isn't that the whole theory of natural selection? I mean, isn't that, if you really understand how natural selection, how the process works, that's part of it. I mean,
no, part of it. Hold on.
Is accepting that fact,
Paul? No, let me explain to you why it does not involve the disregarding of the whole theory of natural selection. I do believe that that when there is some kind of evolutionary advantage to some sort of change, to some sort of mutation, that it does appear to work. That can select out. And that advantage can be carried on. But what that doesn't mean is the creation of a whole new species. In other words, you can see it with dogs. I mean, when dogs are bred, they're often bred by intelligent design to create new breeds with advantages. The whole idea of randomness is the problem. It's not the process of natural selection itself. If you want to stay with us, Paul, please do. We'll come back to you right after the break and get a more informed response from Dr. John West at this Science and Culture Hour on C.S. Lewis, Darwinism and Science.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show. That's 1-800-955-1776.
After the hour on the Michael Medved Show, it's easy to save 15% or even more on car insurance with Geico. Just go to geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. And the only hard part is figuring out which way is even easier. And we always get a great response on our Science and Culture Hour, as we are this time talking about the 50th anniversary of the death of the great C.S. Lewis and his attitudes toward Darwinism and science generally. Paul in Cleveland, you're still with us.
Yes, I am.
Okay, thanks a lot for hanging on. Let me give Dr. West a chance to respond to your point about natural selection.
Yeah, good question, Paul. I don't think anyone challenges, I certainly don't, that natural selection is a real process. I do think, and this isn't just for people who support intelligent design, there is widespread now thoughts and consternation, even in the scientific community, that when you try to have fundamentally new structures, you know, natural selection by definition, because it is not mindful, it's not directed by mind, cannot see future function. And so when you're trying to do something like create metamorphosis in butterflies or create things that don't have a clear immediate advantage, and you have to look down to the future for some advantage, survival advantage, it's hard to see how natural selection can do much into that. And that's why many of the scientists that actually Steve Meyer talks about in his great book, Darwin's Doubt, even who don't support intelligent design, think that there is a real problem with relying on the selection mutation process, sort of classical neo-Darwinism, to explain the sort of wonderful form and function that we see. And so, you know, that is a critique of natural selection. I'd turn it around, and the subject of the video that we've just done on C.S. Lewis and intelligent design is there are a lot of things in nature, whether it be beauty or reason itself, extreme form and function, these molecular machines inside the cell that just speak powerful evidence of intelligent design positively, because we know what intelligent actors can do. They can create things that don't have an immediate advantage. They can create things that work together, the sorts of things we see throughout nature, not only in the human world, but also in our very cells, these thousands upon thousands of molecular machines. And so I just say that there is also a positive case for design, but I'd encourage you to read Darwin's Doubt by Steve Meyer so you could delve into the science.
Paul, go ahead.
I just want to make one point. I guess I see the two processes, natural selection, the theory of natural selection, and so-called intelligent design as diametrically opposed concepts. And the distinction I would make between them is simply goal-directedness. In other words, intelligent design, at least as I've been explained it, requires there to have been a goal in mind, right, behind the design before the process created these species. Natural selection is the opposite. Natural selection happens after the fact. The selection happens after a generation has played out, and those features that conferred a survival advantage for that particular species, that species survived because of that. It was able to pass on the genetic code to the next generation and survive that way. I think the mistake that non-scientific people make when they talk about natural selection is they try to imbue a process, a natural process, with characteristic of the human mind. So it's not hard to believe that the human mind, which is goal-directed, which can think of things ahead of time and behave according to a design, a forethought design, was actually produced by a process that didn't have that characteristic.
Paul, do you know who Lynn Margulis was?
No.
Lynn Margulis was, she's since deceased the past couple of years, she was a National Academy of Science biologist, one of the most premier biologists in our country, not a supporter of intelligent design, but she was actually a fierce critic of what she thought natural selection could and couldn't do. As she pointed out, not a proponent of intelligent design, natural selection is good at breaking things, at making things less complicated. And as an explanation, I think you gave a great description, actually, of the claims of natural selection. Through an unguided, ungoal-directed process, you can get the appearance of design. The problem is that there's now a vast amount of scientific evidence, even admitted by many evolutionists, that substantiate that it can't do that empirically. And so I'd encourage you to read Steve Meyer's book, Darwin's Doubt.
It's posted up at our website. Paul, thanks for a great call. When we come back, the same day that C.S. Lewis died, of course, John F. Kennedy was killed. President Obama honoring President Kennedy. We'll listen to that very briefly coming up on this Science and Culture Hour from the Discovery Institute on the Michael Medved Show.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show. That's 1-800-955-1776. Portions of the Michael Medved Show are brought to you in part by the Discovery Institute. To learn more, click on the Science and Culture banner at michaelmedved.com.
And Christmas is coming up, and so is a week from today, Thanksgiving and Hanukkah. Thanksgiving has been called, first time in memory, so first time since the 19th century that the first day of Hanukkah has actually fallen on Thanksgiving Day. But with Hanukkah and Christmas, everybody's thinking about gifts, right? Here's a great and unique gift idea. You can join Discovery Institute for the Science and Faith Friends or Foes Alaskan Cruise July 26th through August 2nd. And if they decide that Science and Faith are foes, there will be a mixed martial arts squabbling on board the ship. It'll be really exciting. The cruise is going to be a floating intelligent design conference, frankly, featuring New York Times bestselling author Stephen Meyer, along with the renowned Oxford mathematician John Lennox, often referred to as the modern-day descendant of C.S. Lewis. For more information on the intelligent design cruise to Alaska, go to michaelmedved.com and click on the Science and Culture banner. Joined here by John West, who is Associate Director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute. John, of course, the much of the world is focused not on the 50th anniversary of the C.S. Lewis death, but the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John Kennedy. And after a graveside ceremony yesterday at Arlington, where President Kennedy is buried, President Obama gave a lengthy and emotional eulogy that included these words.
He stays with us in our imagination, not because he left us too soon, but because he embodied the character of the people that he led. Resilient, resolute, fearless, and fun-loving, defiant in the face of impossible odds, and most of all, determined to make the world anew, not settling for what is, but rather for what might be.
Okay, I was thinking that virtually everything that he said there could apply to Lewis equally well and probably better than John F. Kennedy. I was particularly wondering what he has in mind where he says defiant for John Kennedy in terms of impossible odds. I mean, right now the Hunger Games movie is coming out tomorrow, and the theme in the Hunger Games, may the odds be ever in your favor. The odds were always in John Kennedy's favor. He was born a fabulously wealthy guy. He got a $1 million inheritance, which at the in those days would be equivalent to $10 million today when he was 21. He was incredibly good looking, incredibly bright. What are the defiant? Where was he defiant against impossible odds? People were talking about either he or his older brother running for president from the time he was born, basically. Do you have any idea what the president meant?
I've long since stopped trying to psychoanalyze or even get into what our president thinks on various things. But I would point out, if you're actually trying to talk about someone who's truly defiant and who stood athwart history to say, you know, there's another truth here, that was C.S. Lewis.
Exactly.
And he was also
fearless and fun-loving.
He was. He enjoyed his pipe. He enjoyed his good drinks. In fact, I had the pleasure of being at a pub just a few weeks ago. His favorite pub across from his college at Cambridge University. And that was quite enjoyable. But
yeah, his idea of fun might be a bit more wholesome than yes. President Kennedy's. But go ahead.
But, you know, the thing is, he also suffered for standing up for the truth. He was, many people consider how brilliant he was, but at Oxford, he was never given a professorship. He was sort of a lowly fellow and tutor because he was voted down, because he was politically incorrect for standing up for his Christian faith and saying that you could be rational and reasonable and believe in God and that it wasn't a stupid thing to do. And so he faced actually a lot of what today we call political correctness, and it was only through the good graces of his friend J.R.R. Tolkien that he was offered a professorship at Cambridge. But he was incredibly honest and forthright and, again, courageous in standing against this, what you might call scientific materialism, and also just the grim legacy of 20th century and 19th century that thinks that human beings are just blind matter in motion. And yeah,
let's go to David in Tampa, Florida. David, you're on the Michael Medved Show with John West.
Hi, Michael. Hi, John. My question was concerning intelligent design. how does it address the idea of infinite regression? Like, for example, if something reaches a certain level of complexity and it's said that it would maybe be designed by an intelligent thing, whether it be a deity or an alien or whatever you want to say, what creates the creator? If it's more complex than the things that it creates, then it would imply, I would think, something that would have to create that by proxy.
Well, I think, I mean, that's a great metaphysical and philosophical question. I think in philosophy and thought, at the very beginning, you have to have some ultimate explanation. And you're really not, there aren't that many alternatives. One is everything ultimately just came from some sort of blind matter and motion. That's the ultimate explanation. Or the other one that throughout human history people have gravitated toward is that it comes from mind and some sort of intelligence. And I think that if you look at those two candidates, I mean, there are only a couple candidates for ultimate explanation. What is the thing that is actually seems more capable of creating the appearance of design that we see throughout nature?
David, if I can just jump in here. Yeah. You're probably aware that all of the recent research, all of the recent scientific writing, and there are no exceptions, points to what's called the Big Bang Theory, that the entire universe originated in some kind of microscopic, infinitesimally small speck of something. Given the fact that there is a consensus of a scientific belief in that origin for our universe, doesn't that suggest mind to you?
I mean, it still doesn't answer the question of the kind of the paradox. If you need a mind to make a mind, you know what I mean?
No, it does answer the paradox, because part of Judeo-Christian belief is that God did not get created. God is. God is infinite, unseen, non-material, and eternal. In other words, that there was no, it's not like, oh, you needed to have a who designed the really, really smart guy who designed everything else. There's no smart guy. We are all products, at least in Judeo-Christian belief, of the mind of God. I think it's very tough for materialists to answer the one question. Okay, let's say paramecium, then you can evolve into Mozart. But how do you get from dead rock to a paramecium or an amoeba or anything that's alive? We'll be right back.
God help me, I'm addicted to
The Michael Medved Show.
A week before Thanksgiving, we are trying to brighten Thanksgiving and the whole holiday season for 20,000 kids. We've gotten about 6,000 or 7,000 taken care of so far. This is through Feed the Children. And you can go to directly, Jeremy, if you can give me the phone number here. If you can go directly to Feed the Children at our website at michaelmedved.com, just click on the Feed the Children banner or call at 800-409-9807. That's 800-409-9807. You can help feed 4 kids for a week for less than $20. It's a great gift for the holidays. We're on with our Science and Culture Hour with John West of Discovery Institute. Let's go directly to William in Greenville, South Carolina. You're on the MedVed Show with Dr. John West.
Hey, Michael and John. Thanks for having me on.
You bet.
I was going to say that it seems earlier some of the calls are getting confused between the difference of macroevolution and microevolution. And the way I've heard it explained, too, is microevolution as a gradual change within species is certainly very possible. You can breed dogs and have them be of different species or different, not species, but different breeds of dogs, or breed cattle to produce better milk and things such as that. But macroevolution, the gradual change of one species to another, where you're going, trying to go from a fish to an amphibian or a reptile, that cannot occur.
John West.
That's a good distinction to make. The basic idea is the more form and function you need to produce, the less likely it is that natural selection alone can produce it.
Let's go very quickly to Will in Skokie, Illinois. You're on the MedVed Show.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hey.
One of the things that strikes me about C.S. Lewis is that he he does away with the thing that, oh, gee, to be a Christian, you have to check your brain at the door. His book, Mere Christianity, was probably the most logical, rational expose for, you know, religion in general and Christianity, in particular Judeo-Christianity.
And by the way, it's one of those, as a non-Christian, as I am, I think that Mere Christianity is absolutely wonderful to read because it helps you to understand your Christian friends and colleagues ever so much better and makes the case in such a brilliant and thoughtful way. Last word, John West, you've written several books about C.S. Lewis. What would he want us to remember most in this 50th anniversary of his passing?
To really try to follow the evidence where it leads. That was a dictum from Socrates that he made the dictum of his whole life.
And following the evidence to where it leads is a process that Discovery Institute exists to help with, particularly the Center for Science and Culture. Go to our website, join them on their big Alaska cruise, wish I could go. It's coming up. You can find it all at michaelmedved.com. Click on the Science and Culture banner and continue following the evidence wherever it leads in this greatest nation on God's green earth.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2013. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.